All right, we're into the life of Christ, and tonight we want to look at two things. Number one, the cleansing of the temple, which was an opening event in the life of Jesus, and that is found in John chapter 2, verse 13. We had his first disciples, then the wedding feast at Cana was his first miracle, and now we have his first Passover. What happened on the first Passover of the ministry of Jesus? And we begin in verses 13 and 14. It is Passover time, and we begin with the condition of the temple. And it focuses on two things. Number one, it focuses on the feast. And number two, it will focus on the robbers. So first of all, the feast, chapter 2, verse 13. It says, "And the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." With the feast, keep in mind that there were three per year at Jerusalem, and the requirement was every male Jew, 12 and up, must attend. So 12 and over males were all required to attend, and of course, if they were married, they would naturally bring their families along. And basically what that is saying then is, as Jesus opens his ministry by cleansing the temple, the city of Jerusalem would be enormously crowded. It would be swollen with people from Galilee, and all the outlying areas were there because of the requirement of the feast. Second, to the feast, if you were a male Jew, you had to bring two things. Number one, you had to bring a lamb. And number two, you had to bring a monetary gift, a half a shekel. Now, it's with these two things that we begin to see the corruption that had involved itself with the temple and how it become commercialized totally. And it will revolve about the fact that you live in Jerusalem and you've got all of these incoming people. They've all got to bring a lamb for a sacrifice. They've all got to bring a monetary gift. And it is your chance to make some cash. And Jesus will judge this particular type of thing. So we focus, number two, on the robbers. And that is not the name that I have assigned to them. It is the name that Jesus assigns to them. Not in the John account, but elsewhere. And we will have, first of all, reading in verse 14, "He found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves." And we'll simply call them the oxen, sheep, dove crooks. The oxen, sheep, dove robbers. And then we will have the money changer robbers. But first of all, the oxen, sheep, and dove robbers. And the background for that is in verse 14, "He found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves." And so the two facts that they're going to capitalize on is the need for a lamb and the need for money to go in the temple treasure. And therefore, the oxen, sheep, dove robbers simply did this. They set up and were assigned concession stands by the temple entry. The concession stands were assigned by the high priest. The high priest was Annas. If you were in with Annas, he would give you a good booth, of course, for a consideration. But you could get a nice concession stand near the entry. And at the concession stands, the way they took care of the lamb problem was very, very simple. Is if you came from Galilee, there was no way you could drag a lamb, or at least it would be very inconvenient, to bring a lamb all the way down from Galilee to Jerusalem. And therefore, for the lamb, these oxen, sheep people, they provided for the people a service. I'll put the word service in quotes, and the service was simply this. They would sell you a lamb at inflated prices, so that you had to balance between the two. What do I want to do? Do I want to try to struggle getting a lamb down from Galilee, or would you rather go down to Jerusalem and just buy one at a concession stand for twice the money? We still have that type of thing in many places today, where you would prefer to take your own refreshments, because if you buy it there, it's going to cost you three times as much. And this basically is what you had with the people who had that concession stand. Second, you say, well, how would you make a business out of the monetary gift? Well, let's look at group number two. And this was the money robbers, or the money changer robbers. Jesus, in one of the accounts, says that these men are involved in a den of robbers, and that's why I'm using the word. First of all, according to Exodus chapter 30, verse 13, every male Jew had to bring for the temple offering at Passover 1/2 shekel. The Jewish leaders had ruled this way. Into the temple treasury, there can go no money with the emperor's image on it. It would defile it. Now can you see the possibility? And that was the coin of the realm. So can you commercialize a little bit and say, if you had a concession stand down here, and here come these people down from Galilee, and all they have in their pocket is money with the emperor's image on it, then you could do them a favor of changing the coin of the realm into coins that were acceptable for the temple. And basically what you would do then, would you say, we will be glad to provide at our concession stand a service for you. We will be happy if you will give us 1/4, and we will change it for you and give you 2 dimes. And that's the way it worked. They were literally purchasing money. Okay, with that then, in verse 15, you have the Lord's reaction to it. The condition of the temple, and now, second, the cleansing of the temple. And that is in verse 15, 16. This event is going to be extremely significant all the way through the life of Christ. So notice in verse 15, we have a picture of his action. And in verse 15, we have the meek and mild Jesus, who made a scourge of cords. Probably he just picked them up from off the ground. They had been selling the cattle there, and doubtless when they sold cattle or a lamb, they would take the cord off its neck and probably pitch it over to the side, and you would go off with your lamb that was inflated in price. And so he probably picked up the scourge from the ground, and it says he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. You get a picture there? You see the consternation. Here, year after year, this fellow's had a concession stand. His parents had a concession stand. It's been in the family. We've always made our living down here. We've always sold lambs at this particular spot. We got regular customers that we rip off every year when they come down for the feast. And they had made excellent money doing it. And this man comes along and takes cords and drives your lambs and cattle out. And you had been changing money. And apparently they had their money sitting out in stacks on the table. The Lord comes along and he upturns the tables. And you can see the coins and the change and the animals and the men and everything else. All that you've got in the 15th verse. Then the significant thing. And by the way, let's put something down about this. I think we can call this a perfect illustration of what we might call righteous anger. Or, if you prefer, righteous indignation. You cannot say that there is no anger here. You cannot say, on the other hand, that it was not righteous. Now, what makes up righteous indignation? Well, I think the answer for that is simply this. There must be two things. There must be a just cause. And number two, there must be a right motive. There must be a right just cause. There must be a right motive. That's what makes up righteous anger. Now, what was the just cause? Notice down at verse 16. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, take these things away. Stop making my father's house a house of merchandise. So the just cause was very simple. Purity of the temple. Anything wrong with that? And what was his motive? Well, you've got his motive in verse 17 where it says his disciples remembered that it is written, zeal for your house has consumed me. So the right motive was zeal. So the just cause was purity of the Lord's house, and the motivation was zeal. And the Lord was angry. And that's what makes up righteous anger. And anyone who really loves truth is capable of this. You see a just cause, You want it maintained, and you're zealous for it. And who it is not maintained, you're angry. And that is legitimate, and that's what the Lord teaches in this context. Second, notice the words in verse 16. Action 15, words 16. To those who were selling the doves, he said, take these things away, stop making. Now catch these next words, because they're going to... These words will be understood in such a way that at this point they will decide we've got to kill him. He says, stop making my Father's house. And those are the important words. He talked about my Father's house. And we'll want to look at how they understood that. But in the first place, notice what he didn't say. He did not say, look at our Father's house. It is his house in a unique sense. So it is my Father's house, not ours. They are not included. He is simply saying that I have a special relationship to this place, and I have a special relationship to the Father that you do not have. He is not our Father. He is not the Jews' Father. He is my Father. Now, for the understanding of that and the way they took it, look at John 5 and verse 18. Because this remark led them to the point they felt they had to put him to death. John 5, 18. Verse 18 says, for this cause, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, but was calling God his own Father. And what did that mean? Making himself equal with God. So, to them, this was a claim to deity. And as he cleanses the temple, he is saying to them, I am God. And they understood it. And it's interesting, when you continue on in John chapter 5, you might say, well, in verse 18, that's what they thought he was saying. Well, if you read the following verses after verse 18, he confirms, you're right. That is exactly what I am claiming to be. And so you have, right at the outset of his ministry, the event that is going to eventually lead to the willingness of the Jews, or the feeling on the part of the Jews they're going to have to put him to death. Okay? This, by the way, establishes for the rest of the life of Christ what we might call a major theme. And the theme that goes from this point on throughout the rest of the life of Christ is his authority. And this will be true of his actions, his authority in his teaching, his authority to act rests on his deity. Or it rests on who he is, namely God. And if there's any one concept that the Jews throughout the rest of the New Testament times will literally hate, is we cannot handle the things that you do with authority. You teach with authority, you act with authority. How can you do this? And his answer is always, it's who I am. I am deity, and therefore, based on who I am, I have a right to act in an authoritative way. In fact, I must act in an authoritative way. All right, to that now, we've got the reaction. And the reaction is of two kinds, or from two groups. Number one, of the disciples, and number two, of the Jews. First of all, the disciples, verse 17. His disciples, upon observing this, remembered that it was written, quote, zeal for your house will consume me. Now notice what they are doing. They are learning to do this. They compare what he does. They'll do this throughout all of his ministry. They compare what he does with what the Old Testament predicted. They were continually looking at the actions or the words of Jesus, and they said, does he fulfill what the Old Testament said the Messiah would do? Turn back just a page to chapter 1, verse 41. Notice, as the disciples begin, they check Jesus out, so to speak. As the Lord has met Andrew, in verse 41, it says he found first his own brother Simon and said to him, we have found the Messiah. How did they know he was the Messiah? The Messiah was predicted in the Old Testament. They looked at Jesus and, is he the one? You got the same thing down at verse 45. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and in the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth. What are they saying? We've compared what we heard him do, what we see in him, with the Old Testament, and we conclude that he is therefore the Messiah. And at this point, what did they do? They saw him with that enormous zeal for the temple, and they said, there it is. He fulfills Psalm 69, verse 9. That's the response of the disciples. They are more confirmed that he is really the Messiah. But there were also the Jews there, and they have a reaction. So the reaction of the disciples, and now the reaction of the Jews, verse 18 of chapter 2. The Jews therefore answered and said to him, what sign do you show to us, seeing that you do these things? Now let me ask several questions right here, and the first one is this. Do the Jews have a right to ask the Messiah for a sign? Do they have a right to do that? Did Jesus come giving signs? He did, didn't he? So we can put down several things. Number one, they had a right to expect signs. Every right in the world to expect signs. After all, the coming Messiah was to have them. The Old Testament had taught them that. So let's put beside that Old Testament. Old Testament had given them many things that you ought to expect when the Messiah comes. So they had a right to expect signs. Second, we know that Jesus came with signs. We'll see lots of them. Signs and wonders. In Acts, we'll read that he was attested by God among them with many signs and wonders and miracles that were all there. So putting our facts together, in checking out the Messiah, they had a right to expect him to have messianic signs. Second, Jesus came with signs. Third, and here's where we need to do some reconciling. Turn to Matthew 16 and verse 4. Matthew 16, 4. And we'll want to reconcile this with the first two statements we've made, their right to expect, and his presentation of signs. Verse 4, Jesus says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. So, the sign seekers are evil. Now, you see the problem we've got? Jesus came presenting signs to authenticate who he was, and yet he turns around and he condemns them for seeking signs. Now take that back to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, verse 18, they say, what sign do you show us, seeing that you do these things? Now how are we going to reconcile and harmonize these three things? Here's our answer. What's the harmony to it? Our answer is this, and we'll be able to demonstrate it easily. The answer is this. They are called evil and adulterous generation, not because they demanded a sign, but because they demanded a sign when they had already been given a sign. So, they demanded a sign when sign evidence had already been given. They demanded a sign after one was already given. That's what makes it evil. In other words, he came along and gave a legitimate sign. They didn't look at it, and then they came along and said, give us a sign. And it would be very much like you say, when I arrive, I will give you a $20 bill. And you arrive and you give the person the $20 bill. They put it in their pocket and they say, where's my $20 bill? Just exactly the same thing. He handed them a sign. They put it in their pocket and said, where are your signs? Now let's demonstrate this three places. I'll give three examples of demanding a sign after one had already been given. Go to John 6. This pattern's all through the Gospels. They're forever doing this. They were demanding a sign when sign evidence had already been given. John 6. After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, or Tiberias, and a great multitude was following him because they were seeing the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Catch that? They were seeing the signs. And Jesus goes up into the mountain in the following verse, and you come down to verse 14. When therefore the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, "This is of truth the prophet who is to come into the world." And in verse 26, Jesus answered and said, "Truly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." And now come down to verse 30. They said therefore to him, What then do you do for a what? Sign. And so what is the point? They demanded a sign after one was already given. And that's why the Lord says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. All right, second example, Matthew 12:22. Among the signs, of course, were miracles, and here's one in verse 22, which says, "Then there was brought to him a demon-possessed man who was blind and dumb, and he healed him. So the dumb man spoke and saw," and of course that is a sign, but look down at verse 38. "Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, 'Teacher, we want to see a sign from you.'" And they had just seen one. They were evil in sign hunting because they had sign evidence, and they demanded a sign after it was already given. Matthew 16, verse 1. You can find lots of good examples of this. It says, "And the Pharisees," after all this thing that has happened, these multitudes of miracles, "the Pharisees and the Sadducees came up and tested him, asking him to show them a sign from heaven." And then you get verse 8. Jesus, aware of this, said, "You men of little faith." And there's the problem. The problem is not lack of evidence. The problem is lack of faith. And says, "Why do you discuss among yourselves because you have no bread? Don't you yet understand or remember the 5 loaves and the 5,000 and how many large baskets you took up? Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many baskets you took up? Can't you remember my miracles?" So, we have three things then. They had a right to expect signs. Jesus came with signs. And yet they are evil and adulterous generation for seeking signs, because when a sign was given, they always ask for another one. They never were satisfied with the one that was given. Now, on that, let's make a few observations. Two of them, basically very similar, but this. Notice the problem was not lack of evidence. Not at all. The problem with the Jews was not lack of evidence. Jesus gave them plenty. The problem was not lack of evidence. Truth was right in front of them. The problem was response to evidence. The problem was not lack of evidence. The problem was lack of response. And we can apply that. How many men and women do you have today that are searching for something to build on? And where is truth? Anyone have any idea? Where is truth? Right in front. It's on your lap. Or on your desk, whichever way. How many of us have stumbled through life in the same way? For lack of the presence of truth? Not at all. Truth is there. Lack of seeking after it. So the problem was not lack of evidence, but response to evidence. And number two, therefore, the problem that we face is never unavailability of truth. The problem is never unavailability of truth. The problem is we do not read and believe the truth that's right in front of our noses. That's the problem. Don't have to search. It's there. All right, now let's close it out with the prophecy. third part, the prophecy of the temple. The condition of it we've had, the cleansing of it, and now the prophecy of it, verses 19 through 22. Back to John 2, 19. Here is the one statement that will be at the root of Jesus' death. Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." First of all, very carefully, note the wording. And the reason we need to note the wording is because it is going to be so horribly misused. And the wording revolves about the two main verbs. The first one is, destroy this temple. In the Greek language, you never have on a verb an understood subject. The subject is always on the end of a verb. For example, if we would say luo, luete, right on the front you have the stem, and the stem means to loose, and this is the inflected ending. Luo is I loose. Luete is second person plural, you loose. And so every time you got a verb, you always know whether it's singular person, singular or plural, and what person it is. All right, the word destroy is a verb. You'd almost gather that in English. What is the subject of the word destroy? What would you take to be in English? You, wouldn't you? You destroy it, and I will raise it up. And that's also true in the ending. So the word destroy is plural ending. It's plural, you. So notice, you destroy the temple. The action of the destruction of the temple is not his. He is not going to destroy the temple. They are going to be the destroyers of the temple. Now, the next verb is, I will raise it up. So the destruction is theirs. The restoration, or raising it up, is his. And it is a singular, I. And I'm not trying to overstress a point, but you'll see why I'm saying this is important in just a moment. Look very carefully at what he said. He looks at the temple. You folks are going to destroy it, but I, singularly, am going to restore it. Destruction is theirs, restoration is his, and there's no way in reading that sentence that you can take it any other way. If you're fair at all with the grammar, that's the only way it can be understood. Okay, now, let's take a look at the way this statement was totally misused. So let's put down the misquote. By the way, the misquote will be the basis of two things. The misquoting of these words will be the basis of the death of Jesus, or at least a basis of the death of Jesus, and it will be the basis of a man who lived after him and preached him. It'll be the basis for the death of Stephen. Malicious misquoting. Go to Matthew 26. Matthew 26. We'll see it, first of all, how it was responsible to a large extent for the death of Jesus. Basically, what this is saying, there is no way you can possibly expect a person to be fair who hates you. There's no way it can be done. And they hate him. And there's no way that he can correct it. They're irrational, they misquote, but they hate him, and therefore they're not interested in being fair. Chapter 26, verse 59. It says, "Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus in order that they might put him to death, and they did not find it, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, "This man stated, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" And notice that's an absolute total misquote. He said he was able to, he said no such thing. And so in their use of it, they exclude themselves from any responsibility and involve him by misquotation, by twisting words, making them say something they did not say at all, and he never said. Very clear. And notice in the following context, with those words, you come down to verse 66. "What do you think?" They answered and said, "He is deserving of death." So it was basis for the death of Jesus. It was also the basis for the death of Stephen. Acts 6. Acts chapter 6. Verse 10. Stephen is preaching, and they were unable to cope with his wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. Then they secretly induced men to say, notice how parallel the death of Stephen is to that of Christ. They tried to get witnesses against him, finally got false witnesses, and they used this temple statement, and they do the same thing with Stephen. Then they secretly induced men to say, "We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God." They stirred up the people, the elders, and the scribes, and they came upon him and dragged him away and brought him before the council. And they put forward false witnesses who said, "This man incessantly speaks against this holy place and the law, for we have heard him say that this Nazarene Jesus will destroy this place and alter the customs of Moses, which Moses handed down to us." And then you find in chapter 8, they are going to stone the man to death. But this was the thing that incited it. So notice how very, very important those words are. Now, let's go back to John 2 and ask a question. Taking his words carefully as he says them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise the temple up." Now, we're told in the following context, verse 21, he was speaking of the temple of his body. But the question we want to ask, why is it appropriate to call his body the temple? There was the physical temple on earth, which was the temple, and Jesus calls his body the temple. Why is that appropriate? Can you think of a reason? There's a very good one. The temple was the seat of God's presence among his people. The temple was, in the Old Testament, the seat of God's presence. Why is it appropriate, then, that he would call his body a temple? Well, it's appropriate because he is God incarnate, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. In other words, we put it this way, both his body and the temple housed deity. Both housed deity. So that when he was raised from the dead, the temple was raised. And we can take it further. All those who rely on him for salvation also become temples. 1 Corinthians 6:19, "Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you?" And so it projects on out to the fact that we are temples. We are temples for the same reason that the temple in the Old Testament was. It was the seat of the presence of God. And we are temples for the same reason that Jesus' body was the temple. It was the seat of the presence of God. And we are temples because of what? Because we are indwelled by him upon salvation, and that makes us also temples. How do we become temples? Where did our templehood come from? What's the fount of it? His resurrection. They destroyed him, he was raised again, And because he was raised again, the temple is now among us, and the temple is now made up of the body of Christ or the church. Okay, now we want to take a look, and we have time to do so tonight, in our next two studies, at two things. Number one, we want to take a look at the miracles of Jesus. And I don't mean look at each one individually, though we will do some of that. I mean, what are the characteristics of Jesus' miracles? Then on Sunday morning at 10, we want to look at Jesus as a teacher. John 7 says, no man ever spoke like this man. So it would be a good idea to look at Jesus as a teacher. But right now, in closing out, we want to look at the miracles of Jesus. All of them together, not one in particular, or not just a few, but all of them. And the first thing to note about miracles is this, is that there is an extremely close link of what Jesus said and what he did. Very close link of his words and works. Very close. And let me show you in three places where this is true. Once with a man named Nicodemus, we'll show that close link. Once with Luke, and once with Mark. And we want to be sure we get a mentality that they had. For example, look at John, just across the page, at John 3. And all I want you to see is the link that was forged in their minds by what this man says and what he does. Chapter 3, verse 1, there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to him by night and said to him, Rabbi, we know you have come from God as a teacher, that's his words, for no one else can do, that's his work, these signs that you do unless God is with him. What is he saying? There is a link, irresistible link, between what you say and what you do. Luke, in Acts 1:1, don't turn to it, I can simply quote it to you, you'll remember it. Luke begins in 1:1 of Acts and says, I'm going to give an account of all that Jesus began, what? To do and teach. To do is his works, to teach is his words. There is a close connection. Look at Mark 1, Mark 1:22. Mark 1:22. In Mark 1:22, we read, and they were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as the scribes. So the focus there is on the works, words of Jesus. Verse 27, and they were all amazed, so that they debated among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority. And what's that connected with? He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. So he commands the unclean spirits, that's his works. A new teaching with authority, that is his words. There is a close link between the words and works of Jesus. Now, second, many of the works of Jesus are what we call miracles. And we ought to get a good working definition of what we mean by an event, by a miracle. A miracle is an event. A miracle is an event wrought by the power of God. Miracle is event wrought by God's power to attest truth. If we look through the miracles of Jesus with this in mind, it's an event wrought by God's power to attest truth. God has preserved the miraculous attesting ability of these things. If you wanted to preserve the effectiveness of a miracle, would you make them common or would you make them rare? How do you make anything effective? By using it all the time? Or if you're going to discipline your children, how do you make it effective? By it being clear and rare, or you're forever saying, I'm going to whip you. You're forever saying it means nothing. And so, the effectiveness has been protected by their rarity. You can look at the periods of miracles in the Bible, and basically, I would put them in several categories. Number one, you had plenty at creation. Then you have a period of silence. And then you come to the next big miraculous thing, which was what? The Exodus. You can chart this, really, if you'd make some kind of scale, and it will look like this. You have a lot of creation, then it levels off, and God remains silent. When Israel was down in Egypt for some 400 years, how many miracles happened? As far as we know, not one single miracle. They all came about the time of the Exodus. And then you come up to basically the next period is under Elisha in the Old Testament, where you have lots of them. Then the next would be in the days of Daniel, and then the life of Jesus, and then the ministry of the apostles, which ended in the first century. And what happened after the first century to miracles? Where are they? Where are the raisings from the dead since the days of the apostles? Haven't been any. What's the next big one? We'll put it in parentheses. We'll be in the tribulation just before the Lord's return. So they miracles chart just like this. You have long periods of silence. As a matter of fact, Sir Robert Anderson has a book called The Silence of God. And in it, he deals with this very thing of how miracles will come in large amounts, and then God will grow silent for many, many, many centuries. What happened between the time of Malachi and the opening of the New Testament? God was absolutely silent. Nothing occurred. So, that is the protecting of them by making them rare. Okay, now let's say some things about the characteristics of miracles. And I'm not going to take time to write all of these out, but let's simply call this the characteristics of miracles. At least I'll write it very briefly. In our closing minutes, we've got about 9 of them. Number one, keep this always in mind. The miracles of Jesus are all within historical framework. They're all within a historical framework. Now, here's what I mean by that. Are they presented as stories, or are they presented as having happened? Looking at, I'll just try John 2, we looked at last week. Is this being presented as though it really happened? And that's what I'm saying. Look at the way it is presented. Does this read like poetry, or does this read like history? How does it read? Verse 1, on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. Are we reading a poem? Is this a fantasy story, or does this read like history? I take it, if we're fair with the text, he's simply saying, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was invited, his disciples to the wedding. That's all historical narrative, isn't it? And when the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, what have I to do with you? My hour is not yet come. His mother says to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Get any implication that this is not history? It's presented in a historical framework. And you come down very matter-of-factly, verse 9, when the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine. Water had become wine. How else would you present it? They're all presented in historical framework as far as the New Testament is concerned. Second, miracles are reasonable. Miracles of the New Testament are all reasonable. If we believe two things. One, God exists. And God is powerful. If God exists and God is powerful, what is unreasonable about a powerful God performing a miracle? There's nothing unreasonable at all about that, assuming those things to be true. If we believe there's an all-powerful God, what is strange about a miracle? If God can do anything, what's unusual about water being turned to wine? Nothing in the world, nothing irrational about it whatsoever. Or we might put it this way. If we believe that God is the creator, is it reasonable to say, God, you can only do it once. Don't you dare do anything miraculous again. Is that reasonable? Miracles are reasonable if we believe in an all-powerful God. That's why the miracles give me no problem in my mind at all. I believe there's a God who has all power. That strange inconsistency is, I was reading one author who argues very strongly for creation in Genesis chapter 1, and yet he says, I have great difficulty with the miracles. And I want to say you're not rational. I mean, if you've already said you've got an omnipotent God, and what you're saying is the omnipotent God can't do it again. Okay, third, the miracles of Jesus are not to entertain, but to help. And these are generalizations about all of them. Not to entertain, but to help. Every miracle of Jesus was helpful. Look at Luke 23 there was an occasion, remember, when someone wanted him to do a miracle for entertainment value. Remember that? Luke 23. And he didn't do it. He never did it for entertainment. It was always helpful, and you can demonstrate that with every one of the miracles. They're all helpful. Chapter 23 of Luke, verses 8 and 9. Jesus is brought in this chapter before Herod. It says, verse 8, Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he had wanted to see him for a long time because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. And he questioned him at some length, and he answered him nothing. So notice when the implication is, hey, do a trick for me. I've been waiting to see this for a long time. He didn't do it. All of the miracles of Jesus, and you can examine every one of them is helpful. Fourth, and this is interesting, I think. The miracles of Jesus, they feed the hungry, they heal the sick, they restore to health. Fourth, they are never used to retaliate. They are never used to retaliate. Never. I think that's remarkable. Never used to retaliate. What's the commercial it used to be on for Don't Try to Fool Mother Nature? With Blue Bonnet? Yeah, was it Chiffon? Whatever. And, you try and fool, and you're struck. You're struck dead by this supernatural being. Jesus never stood in front of a cloud and said, you unbelievers, zap. Never. There is no miracle that is not gracious. Never, never. There was a suggestion once by his disciples that you zap some people with a miracle, and he refused. He rebuked them. Take a look at that. It's found in Luke also, chapter 9. Luke 9. Stop and think for just a moment. If all of the miracles of Jesus are helpful, If they are never filled with wrath, they never retaliate. You know what he's forcing men to do? He's saying, if you reject me, you will reject my grace. And you cannot say that I was not helpful and good and did not feed and help men. You did not have to respond to me because you feared retaliation. You had to reject my grace. Okay, Luke 9:52. He sent messengers. Jesus sent messengers on ahead of him. And they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. And they did not receive him because he was journeying with his face toward Jerusalem. And when the disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them. Jesus' miracles are never used to retaliate. Fifth, they are all gracious. They are all gracious or gratuitous. Every miracle Christ ever performed was gracious. What kind of fee did he charge for his miracles? He said, look, I just healed you. Can't you give our evangelistic team a little boost and help us on to the next town by buying us a bus ticket or a chariot ticket? Never did that happen. They are all no remuneration. In fact, remember he healed once 10 lepers. And only one of them came back to thank him. And he said, boy, will I ever get them. When I see them next time, I'll smite them with leprosy again. Nope. Never. All gracious. All right. Sixth, they are all instantaneous. Where do you find Jesus, for example, meeting a leper? And Jesus attempts to heal him, and the leper says, well, I feel better. And Jesus says, come back next week, and we'll do it again. And the leper comes back next week, much improved, until finally he's healed. Where do you see a miracle like that? They were all instantaneous miracles. Seven, they're all undeniable. Now, I think the best way to prove that is this. It's best proved by showing that even his fiercest enemies didn't deny his miracles. We've got time to look at John 11, 47. John 11, 47. You know, if they had in any way been able to deny them, don't you think they'd done it? If you could have proved him to be fraudulent, wouldn't you have done it? And notice 11, 47. Therefore the chief priests, this is John 11, 47, therefore the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council, and they hate him. And they were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. We can't say he is a fake. If you want to look at another one, you might jot down Mark 3, 22. They did not question his ability to perform miracles. What was the thing they finally had to come up with? We can't question the fact that you do miracles, but we can say this, you do it by the power of what? Of Satan. And that was the lame excuse they had to come up with. Number eight, all of his miracles were open and public. No one could come along and say, we were in an upper room with a group of people and Jesus took me in a closet and he healed me. And now you've got to believe that I was healed. They were all public and they were all open. As a matter of fact, when he comes before Annas, that's one of the points he makes. He says in John 18:20, he says, I've done everything in the temple and above board. And where did he feed the 5,000? In front of the 5,000. Anybody could look. They were open and they were public. And yet they could not be denied. And finally, number nine, they were in a variety of settings. And I'll not take time to write these out, but let me give them to you. A setting of sickness, Mark 1, 29 through 31. In the setting of disease, Mark 1, 41 and 42. In the realm of demon possession, Mark 5. And in the realm of death, Mark 5, 35 through 45. Those are all features of the miracles of Christ. Now, in our next time, we will pick up with the teaching of Jesus and see the characteristics of simplicity, the characteristic of authority, and all of those things that go about with Jesus as a teacher, which we'll pick up on in our next study. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word. For the person of Jesus Christ, we pray that we will recognize that the great stumbling block of the Jews in the New Testament times when Jesus lived was not lack of evidence. There was an abundance of evidence. They rejected the evidence they had. Truth was right in front of them, and they asked for more. And Father, may we realize that truth is in our Bibles. It's right in front of us. May we not make the mistake of doing what the Jew did, of having evidence in front of us and then seeking elsewhere. In Christ's name. Amen.